is the future of China's developing economy, China's developing, new society, and that the United States is trying desperately to hold on to a declining preeminence in the world, and that's a losing proposition, and I think countries are frightened by what the United States may do to try to protect that, and I think many countries are, and certainly many people are very anxious about the state of play.
Thank you very much, Hartley Slanger, spokesman, International Schiller Institute. Ken Hammond, professor of East Asian and Global History at New Mexico State University. Thank you. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitale and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa idh qala Ibrahim Rabbi arini kayfa tuhyil mauta qala awalam tu'min qala bala walakin liyatma'inna qalbi قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. And when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take four of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Forces raid a refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. EU leaders approve 1 million euros in new military aid for Ukraine. And people protest in New York to condemn the chokehold killing of an African-American man. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. In the occupied West Bank, a funeral procession has been held for two young Palestinians killed by Israeli forces on Saturday morning. The two Palestinians, both in their 20s, were fatally shot during the regime's raid on a refugee camp in the city of Tokham. According to local sources, Israeli troops clashed with Palestinians at the camp. They also prevented medics from reaching the injured. The latest Israeli violence raises to 110 the total number of Palestinians killed by the regime so far this year. Around 20 of these victims were under 18 years old. Saturday's killings come amid rising tensions in the occupied territories, where Israel has stepped up its crackdown against Palestinians. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kendall, gave us more details about the latest Israeli killing of Palestinians.
Unfortunately, at this time, Israeli forces raided Nur al-Shams refugee camp in Turkerem, northern the occupied West Bank, and assassinated two Palestinians, 22-year-old Samer Salah al-Shafi'i, as well as 22-year-old Hamza Jamil Khadyush. They were shot and they were left bleeding above the roof of a two-story building inside the refugee camp. Videos came from the refugee camp of Nur al-Shams showing Israeli soldiers surrounding the bodies of the two Palestinians, and they left them bleeding until they passed away. Israeli military just issued a statement now saying that Israeli forces raided the refugee camp of Nur al-Shams in order to kill Palestinians, accusing them of the shooting that was carried out against the settlement of Avni Hefetz outside Tul Kerem, this illegal settlement that was built on the lands of Tul Kerem 4 days ago. So the Israeli military claimed that the forces raided the refugee camp in order to arrest or to kill those whom the military accused them of the shooting against the illegal settlement. Clashes took place between Palestinian residents of the Tul Kerem, of the Ain Shams refugee camp, of Nur al-Shams refugee camp in Tul Kerem, and Israeli forces. The military soldiers pulled out from the refugee camp.
Tehran says the U.S. is responsible for all past and future acts of terrorism by Israel against Iran's nuclear scientists and nuclear facilities. In a tweet, Secretary of Iran's National Security Council Adi Shamkhani says the U.S. should accept the consequences of its support for Israel. This comes after White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said the U.S. will recognize Israel's freedom of action if Iran tries to obtain nuclear weapons. Washington and its Western allies accused Tehran of moving towards the capacity to produce nuclear weapons. Iran has repeatedly dismissed the allegations, citing the strict monitoring of its nuclear activities by the UN nuclear watchdog. Iran has executed the ringleader of a terrorist group who was behind numerous attacks in the country. Habib Farajullah Chab, nicknamed by Habib Asyud, was a leader of the Hat al-Nidal terror group. He had masterminded several terrorist attacks in Iran, including the one on a military parade in the southwestern city of Ahvaz back in 2018. Dozens of people were killed or wounded in that attack. He was running the terrorist group under the supervision of several foreign spy agencies, including the Israeli regime's Mossad. The terrorist group is a secessionist one which focuses on operations in Iran and southwestern Khuzestan province in a bid to create insecurity there and finally to separate it from the country. EU leaders sign off a 1 billion euro ammunition package for Ukraine despite growing financial hardship for citizens throughout the 27-nation bloc. A seventh consecutive hike in interest rates has been confirmed by the European Central Bank. Jerome Hughes reports.
Millions of struggling homeowners with tracker mortgages across the 27-nation eurozone will soon start paying back even more following a decision by the European Central Bank to increase interest rates by a quarter of 1%.
We have covered a lot of ground in the last 9 months, right? Moving from minus 50 basis points to plus 300 basis points. We are continuing this hiking process.
Rents are going up as landlords with mortgages pass on the costs. The aim is to bring down inflation, but disgruntled unions insist the strategy won't work. It's all linked to energy sanctions against Russia. EU citizens are being financially pummeled. However, the bloc's leaders have just agreed on a huge additional package to arm Ukraine.
So we are talking about 1 billion capacity to upscale our industrial base.
Ordinary people don't see an end in sight to the crippling cost of living crisis.
A person who is employed, he can survive, but just think about a person who is not employed, how it is impacting him.
If we don't have also like kind of a push on the wages, we will not be able to cope with that, and our reserves, our savings, we will go down.
Analysts suggest peace in Ukraine is the answer, but EU authorities say Kiev will be supplied with deadly weapons for as long as it takes.
It is for Ukraine, that is the country that has been attacked, to decide in which conditions it is ready to find peace with Russia.
Employment ministers have been assessing pressures on EU businesses due to high inflation and interest rates. Firms are also struggling to find skilled workers.
26% of companies all over Europe consider that labour shortage are a major difficulty for them.
Economists say because EU leaders have cut off cheap gas and oil flows from Russia, winter 2023 will tell us all we need to know about the bloc's resilience or lack thereof. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
People in Britain are questioning the costly coronation ceremony for King Charles III amid a cost of living crisis and nationwide strikes over pay. The ceremony is to be held on Saturday and it will be funded by the government. Estimates put the cost of the coronation ceremony as high as $130 million. Anti-monarchy activists say the cost is a slap in the face for millions of people struggling with a cost of living crisis. They say the coronation is a celebration of hereditary power and has no place in modern society. A recent survey shows most of the British people want the coronation to be funded by the royal family itself. A spokesman for the Buckingham Palace has argued that the occasion attracts huge global interests that more than repays the expenditure which goes with it. New Yorkers have staged a protest outside the Manhattan District Attorney's office demanding criminal charges over the chokehold killing of a black man by a former white Marine. We discuss the issue with our guests in our news review program.
Another protest is held in the U.S. over the death of a black man, Jordan Neely, who was killed by a white former Marine in New York. The protesters chanted justice for Jordan as they gathered outside the Manhattan District Attorney's office on Friday. They called Neely's death an act of lynching, likening it to the murder of George Floyd by white officers in 2020. Neely, a mentally ill homeless man, died on Monday. A video circulating online shows a former Marine holding him in a chokehold before he faints and later succumbs at a hospital. A New York medical examiner has called his death a homicide. However, the Manhattan District Attorney has refrained so far from announcing any charges against the Marine involved in his death. And now joining us for our news review program is Colin Campbell, joining us from Washington, D.C., and Gerald Horn, professor of African American Studies, joining us out of the University of Houston in Texas. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. Colin, we're going to start with you. Colin, there are reports that this gentleman was belligerent and a little bit erratic, but we both know that this doesn't justify what happened to him. What do you know about the story?
Well, right now, one of the most important things to note is that the man who allegedly killed Jordan Neely has not been charged. He was released by police, and that's why protesters are so upset, and that's why many people are so aggravated at what happened to Jordan Neely. Now, of course, people say that there are lots of people on the subway. Every once in a while, you get people who might seem that they aren't totally cognizant of what's going on. They may be belligerent, they may be annoying, they may be pestering. But one thing that I think goes beyond the limit is a type of vigilantism. And that's what it seems like this Marine, U.S. Marine, 24-year-old U.S. Marine who has not been identified, has engaged in a type of vigilantism. And it's also very troubling that as this Marine put Neely in a chokehold, two other people were holding down Neely's arms. So essentially it was like a lynching. It was like just murdering someone on the subway, right? And I think that's what's most troubling about this, is that no one's been charged in it. We do know that Neely was known to be a Michael Jackson impersonator, someone who other people have described as homeless. So he was already facing adverse situations. This is not a person who was just having a bad day and decided to take it out on subway passengers. This is someone who has been dealing with lots of difficulties along the way. And, you know, did deserve to be treated with some kind of respect. But what we're seeing here is somebody who was on the subway, apparently enraged another passenger, and that passenger put him in a chokehold, and he later, Neely later died. We also know, we have to remember, these chokeholds have a precedent of leading to death, when we know about Eric Garner, who was killed by a police chokehold several years ago, and many more cases, but probably the most notable one is when Eric Garner was killed by police using a chokehold. And now we see another young black man being killed by a type of vigilantism, which we have seen with the Ahmaud Arbery case, which we've seen with the Trayvon Martin case, with Zimmerman in Florida. So this is something that continues to occur, and I think that people are just frustrated over this. They're tired of it, and they want to see some justice.
Thank you, Colin. And Professor Horn, welcome to the program, sir. Now, Professor Horn, I'm sure we've all seen people out in public that suffer from mental issues. I have on a street corner, or you know, up and down a sidewalk when their schizophrenia or one of their issues kicks in and gets hold of them for a few minutes. Last thing we think to ourselves is to restrain that person, or even if we think that, last thing we think from there on is to take that person's life. Why do you feel charges have yet to be brought against this young Marine?
It's important for your audience to realize and recognize that it's not coincidence, it's not happenstance, that Mr. Jordan Neely happens to be black. That is to say, when watching how he was murdered, it reminded me of the bad old days of slavery. That is to say, when black people were treated so shabbily and so atrociously. And we also should not see it as an irrelevant detail that the accused murderer has served time in the U.S. military, has had two overseas deployments. When I read that, I was thinking perhaps he was deployed in Afghanistan or Iraq. Perhaps he learned that chokehold in Afghanistan or Iraq. Perhaps he even used that chokehold against Afghanis or Iraqis. Also, we should see that Mr. Neely having this mental episode is a reflection of the fact that the United States has very poor social welfare measures, which is one of the reasons why it has one of the largest homeless populations in the world in this apparent rich country. And likewise, a disproportionate percentage of those who are unhoused, who are homeless, happen to be black. It's also clear that the United States, as presently constituted, is incapable of dealing with the foregoing issues. I think it's incumbent upon our friends in the international community to raise this question at the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva, at the General Assembly of the United Nations in New York City, because we should also recognize that, as I just referenced, the fact that the accused was deployed overseas, there is a connection between this kind of brutality that the U.S. military exercises overseas and the kind of brutality that it exercises at home.
All right, gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on the program. Stay safe, both of you. That was Professor Gerald Horn there joining us, Professor of African American Studies there, joining us from the University of Houston, Texas, and Dr. Colin Campbell. They're joining us from Washington, D.C.
Sudan's army says it has sent a delegation to Saudi Arabia for a planned truce talks with the rival Rapid Support Forces as fighting persists in the African country. The army says that the aim is the extension of the current ceasefire agreed with the RSP. This is while the warring sides earlier said that talks in Jeddah will only focus on a humanitarian ceasefire. They said that they will not discuss ending the war. The army and the RSP are fighting a battle for the control of the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. Multiple ceasefires have been agreed since the fighting erupted on April 15th, but none of them has been respected. The conflict has so far killed hundreds of people and displaced hundreds of thousands. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Test of faith in the heat of battle. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam, dear listeners, and today we present you a special feature on the anniversary of one of the crucial events in the history of Islam and humanity. It is the 15th of Shawwal, which reminds us of an armed encounter that was imposed by pagan Arabs on Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. This encounter, in which the Muslims suffered a setback and barely avoided, defeated, because of their heedlessness to listen to the Prophet, serves as an immortal lesson for believers in all eras and all places. Before going into details, we recite to you ayahs 166 and 167 of Surah Ali Imran regarding the Battle of Uhud that drew a line between the faithful and the hypocrites, those who defended the Prophet and those who fled to the battlefields. What befell you on the day when the two hosts met was by Allah's permission, so that He may ascertain the faithful and ascertain the hypocrites. When they were told, "Come, fight in the way of Allah, or defend yourselves," they said, "If we knew any fighting, surely we would have followed you." That day, they were nearer to unfaith than to faith. They say with their mouths what is not in their hearts, and Allah knows best whatever they conceal. When the infidel Arabs, with the connivance of the Jews and the hypocrites amongst the Muslims, assembled a strong force and marched upon Medina in the hope of obliterating Islam, the Messenger of Mercy had no other choice but to defend Islam and the honor and dignity of Muslims by mobilizing those who claimed to be his followers, in order to thwart a well-equipped 3,000-strong invading force of Arabs led by Abu Sufyan, who had concluded a pact with the ever-rebellious Israelites to kill the Prophet and wipe out the call of monotheism. The wordings of the ayahs that we recited to you indicate that the result was a setback for the new Muslims, in whose ranks were many a weak faith, and of course, munafiqin or hypocrites, who failed the test as defenders of faith at the battlefield of Uhud outside Medina in 3 AH, a year after the Prophet, with unseen assistance from the one and only Creator, had won a decisive victory in the first ever armed encounter imposed upon him by the pagan Arabs of Mecca at Badr. It is obvious that the success of the Prophet of Peace had increased the enmity of the Arabs towards him and towards his word. And dearest cousin, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, whose flashing blade had dispatched to the bowels of hell some of the prominent Meccan warriors, the very same Ali who, on the night of Hijrat, had made the pagan plot of murdering the prophets go awry by sleeping on his cousin's bed so as to allow the latter to migrate to Medina undetected. If vain pride against mingling with the supposedly lower classes had prevented the idolatrous Arab aristocrats of Mecca from accepting the Prophet's call of universal brotherhood, it was racism on the part of the Israelites of Hejaz, whose forefathers had migrated from Syria to await the last and greatest messenger mentioned in the Torah, that made them spurn the heavenly message of the peerless scion of Abraham's firstborn son, Ishmael. On the eve of the Battle of Uhud, Abu Sufyan and the Banu Nadir Jew, Ka'b al-Ashraf wasted no time in forging an alliance against Islam, which continues to persist today under supervision of the U.S. in the form of Zionism. Thus, on the day of Uhud, prior to the start of the battle, Abdullah ibn Ubay and his 300 followers broke ranks with the Prophet and returned to Medina, leaving only 700 new Muslims to face the Israelite-inspired Arab force. Nevertheless, the Prophet, as commanded by God, resolved to hold his ground so that the heat of the battle against overwhelming odds will be a further test of faith for those remaining with him in order to determine who really are the true believers and who really are the weak of faith, if not outright hypocrites. It would be repetitive to refer to the valor of Imam Ali, peace upon him, in disposing of several Arab warlords, along with equally brave uncle Hamza, peace upon him, and how, after the Meccans had been scattered, the guards posted at the mountain pass by the Prophet left their positions to join in the loot of the enemy's baggage, thereby allowing the infidel commander Khalid ibn Walid to attack the Muslims from behind and turn a virtual victory into a near defeat. The result was the fleeing of almost all the new Muslims from the battlefield on the assumption that the Prophet had been killed. Refer to Ayahs 144 and 153 of Surah Al-Imran. While 70 steadfast believers attained martyrdom, including Hamza, peace upon him, whose liver was ripped from his body by the Abyssinian Wahshi to be chewed by his mistress Hind bint Utbah, wife of Abu Sufyan, mother of Muawiyah and grandmother of Yazid. She was dancing and singing in the lute tones to inspire the pagans by offering herself as the prize. "We are the daughters of the night star. We walk on soft carpets. Our prance does admiration tell. Our hands are perfumed musk smell, pearls are strong around these necks of us. So come and embrace us. Whoever refuses will be separated forever. To defend woman, is there no worthy lover? His brave uncle's martyrdom greatly saddened the prophet, but he continued to hold his ground despite desertion by his companions. Later on, returning to Medina, he set the precedent for Muslims to commemorate the martyrdom of Hazrat Hamza, peace upon him, from the soil of whose grave the prophet's immaculate daughter, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, molded beads and made a rosary when he rushed to the field of Uhud on hearing of the injuries incurred by her father. All books of hadith and history state that the lone person standing beside the Prophet of Islam and warding off the repeated assaults of the Arabs was Imam Ali, peace upon him. Later, some 13 other Muslims returned to the battlefield after being assured the Prophet was alive. As could be gleaned from the book Al-Mustadrak As-Sahihain by the famous Sunni Muslim scholar Hakim Naishaburi, the only one defending the Prophet was his cousin and son-in-law, Imam Ali, peace upon him. He has recorded a hadith that reads, Ali has four distinctions which no one shared with him. He was the first male who prayed with the Messenger of God. He was the bearer of his banner in every battle, and he was the one who stayed with him at the battle on the day of Al-Mihras, the Battle of Uhud, and he's the one who washed his blessed body and laid him in his grave. Later, the Prophet, while praising the faith and swordsmanship of his dear cousin, said that on the day of Uhud, Archangel Gabriel could be heard chanting, La fata illa Ali, la saif illa Dhulfaqar. There is no braver youth than Ali and no sharper sword than Dhulfaqar. No wonder the enmity towards Imam Ali, peace upon him, increased in the hearts of the hypocrites, whose ranks would greatly increase in the next few years as Islam spread through Arabia and the pagan Arabs, including those that had fought the Prophet, felt no other choice but to pay lip service to Islam, while their breast brimmed with hatred, in order to conspire with the Israelites against the blessed Ahlul Bayt after the passing away of the Seal of Messengers. These are the immortal lessons of the Battle of Uhud for today's Muslims, whose ranks are unfortunately split, while their archenemies, the US and the illegal Zionist entity, are preparing for the kill. In such a situation, only firm adherence to the path of the Prophet and treading the footsteps of Imam Ali, peace upon him, is discerning. Divine leadership will help them defeat the despicable enemies.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. And in today's episode, we'll be discussing two major issues pertaining to India's involvement in the South Caucasus region and also the rupee becoming the trading currency between India and Malaysia. So stay tuned.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the growing relation between India and Armenia and New Delhi's resistance to the establishment of Zangezur Corridor. And we shall also take a look at rupee coming up as a trading currency between India and Malaysia, thus reducing the monopoly of the dollar.
Since decades, the South Caucasus has played a relatively minor role in India's foreign policy. However, over the past several years, the scenario has changed. The geographical location of the South Caucasus countries being important has provided a viable corridor for India's connectivity with Russia and Europe through Central Asia and Iran. The region also has the potential to meet some of India's requirements of raw material and technology, including oil and gas, minerals, and also gold and uranium.
In the past few years, there has been a gradual interest in the region, and New Delhi's strategy towards the Caucasus countries has seen a change. There have been economic and political developments indicating India's growing interest in the economic and infrastructural potential of the South Caucasus. However, India's interests in the region are not at par with those of other global players. Yet at the same time, the region's importance for New Delhi cannot be ignored owing to its geopolitical location. Amongst the South Caucasus countries, Armenia is relatively the closest partner of India. Armenia is the only country in this region with which India has a treaty relationship. Fresh impetus to political interaction was provided by Prime Minister Modi's meeting with his Armenian counterpart in 2019, which was followed later by Indian External Affairs Minister's visit to Yerevan in 2022. Armenia is also the largest recipient of India's development assistance. On the contrary, there have been no foreign delegation visits between India, Georgia, and Azerbaijan. Armenia and Azerbaijan are members of the International North-South Transport Corridor, of which New Delhi is a part. India has also been supporting Yerevan's proposal to include Chabahar Port in INSTC. For now, India's assessment is that bilateral trade with Armenia is bound to benefit once a free trade agreement between India and the Eurasian Economic Union, currently under negotiations, gets concluded.
Azerbaijan has been pushing to establish the Zangezur Corridor project, a proposed transport corridor that would link it to the Nakhchivan Autonomous Region, a western exclave of Azerbaijan, separated from the rest of the country by Armenian territory. The proposed Zangezur Corridor is also part of a larger transportation project connecting Baku to Istanbul in European Turkey. However, India has been opposing the project as the Iran-Armenian border provides New Delhi access to the Persian Gulf and the Black Sea, circumventing the Suez Canal and bypassing Azerbaijan, with which India shares lukewarm ties.
Armenia is interested in deeper cooperation with India as both the countries share similar geopolitical goals. On the other hand, Azerbaijan and Pakistan form an increasingly close partnership. Islamabad does not recognize Armenia officially, thus fostering close relationship with Baku. Yerevan has been in conflict with Baku over Nagorno-Karabakh. This broader geopolitical setting explains Armenia's efforts to build closer military, technological, and generally diplomatic relations with India. In recent years, there have been important breakthrough agreements on defense supplies from India to Armenia. According to foreign policy experts, the common interests of New Delhi and Yerevan could be the reason behind the decision by the Armenian government to grant India a $40 million deal to supply 4 India-produced weapon-locating radars to Armenia. The Zangezur Corridor has been actively opposed by the Indian government, which sees it as an obstacle to its access to the north. The worry is that if Armenia loses its land connection with Iran, India's ambitious plan for reaching Europe via the INSTC will be imperiled. Maintaining strong ties with Armenia, Iran has been against a project which it thinks could have consequences for Russia and China as well. For India, Iran plays an important role in its connectivity projects to link Central Asia and Europe. In view of New Delhi's alignment with Tehran and Yerevan, the opposition to Zangezur Corridor will almost certainly persist with its current foreign policy.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Senior Fellow and Head of West Asia and Central Asia Tillotoma Foundation, Ms. Meena Singh Roy from Delhi. First of all, welcome to the program, Miss. Now, the ties between India and Armenia have been growing in recent years, with the two countries engaging even in an arms trade deal. So the question is New Delhi trying to fill in the Russian vacuum for Yerevan?
Well, you see, if we look at India's relations with the Caucasian countries, and particularly Armenia, they've been growing, as you said. But this is not to replace Russia or any other country. I think India has always built its relations with an individual country based on its own national interest, based on, you know, its foreign policy goals. And that is what is happening when we look at India-Armenia relations. For past few years, you know, you must have noticed that India's relations with Armenia have grown many folds. And particularly the main pillar of its relationship is also the defense cooperation, which we see growing today. And India was the, you know, it recognized, you know, Armenia's independence. And since then, you know, after 1991, and you know, it's the relationship has been growing, but not at the pace which it has grown in past few years. So it also, you know, reflects the geopolitical changes which are happening globally and regionally. So it is not to replace Russia or any other country, but to sort of maintain relations based on its own strengths.
Mrs. Singh Roy, the region also meets India's demands of oil, gas, minerals, and etc. So how do you see the relation between India and the South Caucasus states evolving in the coming years?
Actually, if you look at the region, India's ties with Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Georgia, mainly, you know, its ties have grown with Armenia. As far as the oil, gas, and other resources are concerned, you know, Armenia doesn't have the resources, but India has invested in Azerbaijan, the ONGC. But it is not the main source of, India's energy imports. The major, energy demands of India are met from the Gulf region. So from that point of view, I would say Armenia is the only country with which India has grown its relations in past few years. But if we look at Azerbaijan or Georgia, they are not that important. Yet it is, but in future, I think, the changes would be happening, but the focus would still continue to be on Armenia. That is what I can foresee. It is not to deny the fact that India would not grow its ties with Azerbaijan and Georgia, but Armenia would remain the key pillar of bilateral cooperation in the region.
Mr. Singh Roy, India has been opposing the construction of the Zangezur corridor, being on the same page with Iran. So to what extent will the construction of the corridor impact India's interests in the region?
If we look at, India's past relations with the region, India has invested heavily in building the infrastructure, connectivity issues in that sense. But as far as the corridor, Zangezur corridor is concerned, it is for the two countries to decide what they want. And there are issues and the problems when we are talking about the corridor. First of all, even Armenia and Azerbaijan, are not on the same page. Armenia doesn't, yes, there was an agreement signed after the war, which talks about, acceptance of the building of corridor. But Armenia and Azerbaijan themselves, there is an issue between two of them. And as far as India is concerned, I think for India, the International North-South Transport Corridor is a key to connecting, India via Iran to Central Asia and beyond. So this is what India would be very much keen to see, these countries being Iran, particularly Iran, Russia, Armenia, part of the International North-South Transport Corridor. So what two countries would do between themselves is not something which I guess India would be looking at. But yes, India's focus is going to be more on the International North-South Transport Corridor, on building infrastructure in cooperation with Iran. So that is what I guess is going to be the focus of India.
Last but not least, Miss, Azerbaijan's close ties with Pakistan have not been taken well by India. The establishment of the corridor will lead to greater influence of Pakistan and Turkey in the region. So to what degree will it affect the growing interests of New Delhi in the South Caucasus?
Let me put it, the answer in the following manner. Number one, you said that how, Pakistan's cooperation with Azerbaijan and Turkey's, involvement in that and their position, generally on Kashmir has been a problematic issue. And that would continue to remain as far as India is concerned. Because India doesn't believe that Kashmir is an issue which needs to be advertised, these forums. And it is a bilateral issue between India and Pakistan, and they have to solve it. Secondly, for India, I think, maintaining bilateral ties with most of the countries is an important factor. If you look at the way India has helped Turkey after the earthquake happened, India was the first country to offer the humanitarian help to Turkey. So I believe India pursues its foreign policy based on its own values, which it has followed in past, and it will continue to do so. And in this respect, India has also helped Pakistan. So when, there is a difference of opinion or something which is inimical to India's national interest, India will object to it. But as far as building corridors and infrastructure development is concerned. These are long-term, you know, developmental projects which the countries would do or they would cooperate. But I don't think India would get into any kind of an objection saying that you can't build it. That is not how it works, in the international relations. But India would bilaterally want to build good ties with all the countries in the Caucasus. That's what it is.
On that note, I would like to thank Mrs. Meena Singh Roy from Delhi for being on the program. She's a senior fellow and head of West Asia and Central Asia Teletoma Foundation. Thank you for being on the program, Miss. Now, let's see what people around the world had to say.
Jora tweeted, Indian Defense Ministry confirms that Armenia bought 307-piece, the indigenous advanced towed artillery gun system, 155mm-52 caliber, from India. Indian Aerospace Defense News wrote, reports, India in talks with Armenia and Iran for a new trade route to Russia and Europe. Iran and Armenia are already building a transit road bypassing Azerbaijan. Vermedia tweeted, Armenia and India are negotiating the signing of a bilateral agreement on international road transport. Yerevan also considers the connection of New Delhi to the Persian Gulf Black Sea International Transport Corridor possible.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh.
Since the U.S. sanctions on Russia, the de-dollarization trend is gaining momentum. Many countries are slowly shifting towards local currencies for international trade transactions in order to reduce their dependency on the U.S. dollar. Just recently, India's Ministry of External Affairs announced that India and Malaysia can now conduct trade using the Indian rupee as a mode of settlement in addition to other currencies. This development comes as India seeks to insulate its trade from the impact of the ongoing Russia-Ukraine conflict and its subsequent fallout.
On the first of this month, the Indian Ministry of External Affairs issued a statement saying that trade between India and Malaysia can now be settled in Indian rupee, in addition to the current modes of settlement in other currencies. This follows the decision by the Reserve Bank of India in July 2022 to allow the settlement of international trade in Indian rupee. This initiative by the Reserve Bank of India is aimed at facilitating the growth of global trade and support the interests of the global trading community in Indian rupees. Union Bank of India has become the first bank in India to implement this option. The Indian Bank has opened a special rupee Vostra account in partnership with the International Bank of Malaysia. The Indian government has already permitted banks from 18 countries, including Malaysia, to open special rupee Vostra accounts to settle payments in the Indian currency. A press release by the Union Bank of India stated, "This move will enable Indian and Malaysian traders to invoice trade in Indian rupees and obtain better pricing for goods and services traded. This mechanism is expected to benefit traders on both sides, as they can directly trade in Indian rupee and save on currency conversion spreads."
Malaysia has fortified its bilateral economic and commercial relations with India, making it India's third largest trading partner in the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, and the 13th largest trading partner overall. In turn, India ranks amongst Malaysia's top 10 largest trading partners. However, much of the exchange between the two nations has been conducted in the US dollars, which has resulted in additional expenses for the businesses. The transaction to local currencies is expected to decrease such costs and stimulate greater trade and investment.
India and Malaysia's trade and investment ties have a long-standing history, and in recent years, bilateral trade has been growing consistently. The bilateral trade volume in the April to November period of 2022 reached a staggering $13.86 billion, with Malaysia's investments in India reaching an approximate amount of $7 billion. India's primary exported items to Malaysia consist of petroleum products, organic chemicals, iron and steel, nuclear reactors, boilers, and electrical equipment, while its imports include animal or vegetable fats and oils, mineral fuels, mineral oils and products, and petroleum. Over 150 Indian companies, including 61 joint ventures, are operating in Malaysia across various sectors, such as textiles, drugs and pharmaceuticals, specialty chemicals, biotechnology, and healthcare. India has been endeavoring to advance the use of the Indian rupee in international trade settlements, and the agreement with Malaysia represents a significant stride in this direction. India has inked similar agreements with Iran, Russia, and the United Arab Emirates. The agreement is likely to encourage other nations in the region to pursue similar arrangements, boosting economic relations and lessening dependence on the U.S. dollar in international trade and finance.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by economist Mr. Sayyed Javed Hassan from Islamabad. First of all, welcome to the program, sir. Now, India and Malaysia have recently agreed to conduct trade using the Indian rupee as a mode of settlement. So how is this going to impact their bilateral trade relations?
There are a number of benefits in using the domestic currency, the local currency, which is rupee, Indian rupee in this case. First of all, it will reduce the transaction costs. You know, converting from dollar to rupee, converting to dollar to the Malaysian currency, they all